Right. We have today our natural reflex to the wonder of God. Our natural reflex to the wonder of God. Right. We have a few families that are with the baby dedication today. How many of you have ever taken a child to a six-month checkup? Anybody done that before? Okay, a few of you, several of you. And then you have the year, and now it's kind of like constantly in there. And they get on you when you miss it by a month or a year or a few days. But you got to keep doing it, right? Keep going back, and they check how these little babies are growing. And they check their reflexes. I remember one of the first, I think this is Seth's 6 month. This is the most fresh in my mind. We take him in there and the doctor's checking, and then of course come the immunizations, and so the doctor gets out this big needle, and for some reason he set it down and looked away, was getting something else, and as he's done that, we found that there's a reflex of a child to grab. Children, that's one of their reflexes. And Seth, he just grabbed that needle and started swinging it around. And the doctor had a reflex. He was cursing and swearing and was surprised at that reflex. I still remember that. I don't think that doctor is any longer a pediatric. He's not a pediatric doctor. And I'm not going to give his name, but that was a close call. Right? These kiddos, they have these reflexes even from childhood. Well, our Creator places in all of us not just that kind of reflex, but a reflex to respond to Him. And His children respond to His glory in a very specific way. And we find that here in our text, in our psalm. If you would look at Psalm 139 in front of you, there's several different sections. We're going to look at it in just 2 points, and it's just that. In verses 1 through 16, we're going to meditate on the glory of God, look at Him, and then verses 17 to 24, we respond to what we've seen. And so we muse or meditate on the glory of God, and we'll find that as His children, we will have the same response that the psalmist does in verses 17 to 24 as he responds to His glory. And it'll be a really enjoyable psalm for us together today. So let's look at this. We're going to meditate on God's wonder, first of all, in verses 1 to 6. Meditate on God's wonderful knowledge. Meditate on God's wonderful knowledge. O Lord, you have, as I read verses 1 to 6, just kind of let the no words jump out at you. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down, when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down. Look at the next one. You are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. You have enclosed me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it. And so we see the psalmist thinking about God's knowledge, the intensity of His knowledge. Look at all these no words. Verse 1, to know, right? And to search. Verse 2, to know and understand. Verse 3, to scrutinize, to be intimately acquainted. Verses 4 and 6, to know and to know. Right? This knowledge of God searches us out in verse 1. It's like God's knowledge goes wherever we go, searching for us, and He knows where we are. Word know is used in this psalm more than any other psalm. It's a response of the psalmist thinking of God's glorious knowledge. He knows and He understands, verse 2, right? The understanding is to perceive. It's not just God knowing the facts about you, how much you weigh, your shoe size, right? Your name, where you're born. These are all things that he knows about you, but then he perceives you. You heard someone say, no one really gets me. That's the idea. God gets you. He understands and perceives and knows you. He knows your how you tick, right? He knows the inner searching of you. He really perceives and understands you. But then he gets more intense yet in verse 3. He scrutinizes you. The idea is to measure. Right? God measures. He has this measuring line that he follows you. Get this picture of a guy who hits a home run or maybe even golf, where they track the distance on the screen. Have you ever seen that? As they're hitting the home run or the golf ball, and you see the line and it shows 400 feet or 300 feet. And it's measuring how far. Well, God is, he always has that measuring on you, on all of us. He always has that, not chip, but I don't know what kind of technology does this. But he always is following us, measuring everywhere we're going. He's scrutinizing all of our steps. Right? He's intimately acquainted, he's saying. Right? He's intimately acquainted with us. Unbelievable extent of his knowledge. Then just briefly here, look at what all he knows. He knows all these things. I kind of have a little chart there in front of you. He searches you, right? God searches and knows you. Look at what else. So we looked at kind of the action of the knowledge. Now we're looking at all the objects of it. What else does God know about you? Look at verse 2. He not only knows and searches you, verse 2, what else does he know about you? He knows when you sit down. The idea is often used to talk about in the Bible, the same word, to set up camp. Right? He kind of knows every time you place your camp and you set up your tent, God knows every place that you rest your head. And then he knows when you get up. When you get up every day, when you get up from the worship service today. God knows that. He knows when you sit down and when you get up. Look at the next one in verse 2. The end of verse 2 there. He not only knows every time you get up and sit down, he knows what? Your thoughts. God knows your thoughts from a distance. God knows every single thing that you think. That's how he can really perceive you and understand the inner workings of your mind. He discerns the thoughts and intents of the heart, Hebrews says. This is God. You cannot fool him. Your motives are not hidden from him. No fig leaves hide his knowledge. Even your thoughts, even what you're thinking now, is an open book to this holy God. Verse 3, he scrutinizes your path. All of your pathways are in his hand. Your commute, right? Your daily pathway. God sees all of that. All of your paths. You just think of your life as a pathway. God knows all of it. And he scrutinizes your lying down. He doesn't just measure that pathway, but every time you lie down to sleep, he sees you. He knows you. Your coming day. What's your day like tomorrow? Got a lot going on. God knows all about it. He knows what's going to happen tomorrow to you. He knows what path you're going to be taking a year from now, 3 months from now. This is the amazing nature of God's knowledge. He measures all of that. The New Living Translation picks up on that idea. Listen to what it says. It says, you see me when I travel and when I rest at home. And God sees all of your traveling, all of your resting, all of your pathways. He's intimately acquainted with all of those ways, verse 3. Jesus said it this way, what is the price of 2 sparrows? 1 copper coin? Not a single sparrow can fall to the ground without your Father knowing it. The very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You're more valuable to God than a whole flock of sparrows. God knows everything going on in your life. All of your bills and frustrations and acquaintances, all of your days. And then verse 4, not just your thoughts, but all your words, right? Every word that you will ever speak, God knows it even as it's on your tongue before you speak it. And so he responds this way in verse 6, in worship, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. God's knowledge is wonderful. It's too high. I can't grasp this type of knowledge. I can't reach it. I can't understand it. Because just like his knowledge to you is that way, his knowledge to me is that way. And to everyone all over, the billions of people all over the earth, God knows everything going on in every person's life. He knows it all. This gives us great comfort, meditating on God's knowledge, does it not? Move on in verses 7 to 12, not only his knowledge of us, but his presence with us. Meditating on God's wonderful presence. Verse 7 and following, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me, and your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to you, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. And so these, kind of this stanza, these verses deal with God's presence, the wonder of God's presence, and helps us meditate on the fact that God is here, that God is near. He does so by giving a question, several ifs, and then the answers to that question. The question is right there in verse 7. It's on the screen in front of you. Could we read this all out loud together? Let's read this out loud together. Verse 7, the question. Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? That's the question. Where could I go? And then he gives several ifs to kind of put some suggestions of perhaps a place where God is not. If I go here, maybe God is not. If I go here, maybe God is not. So let's look at the ifs, right? Well, if I ascend to heaven, what if I take the wings of the dawn? What if I make my bed in the grave, the netherworld, Sheol? What if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea? What if I try to go in the darkest place ever? Right. What if I try to hide from God in some way? Well, you can't get away from God. You can't hide from Him. Right? You and you sent Sarah and I this past week to the depths of the ocean. Not to the depths of the ocean, but where the depths of the ocean. We were at one point miles below us was land. And literally ocean stretched for miles. And yet the ocean stretches farther still. There are places in the ocean that have never been discovered. Places that it's like almost 7 miles deep. We probably will never be able to get there in humanity. Right? Mount Everest could be down there and it would still not be seen. In fact, there would be a mile of water on top of it. And so the psalmist is thinking and he's saying, well, let me say, if I could just go to the remotest part of the sea, what if you went to the darkest part of the sea? Well, you're never going to get there. But even if you did, God would already be there. You can't hide from our glorious God. It's so deep that no one else will get there, but the omnipresent God is there. He is always everywhere. This is a comforting thing that God's presence is with us. He's actually with us here today. All right? In a special way, as the church is gathered, the temple of God is here. And He is here with us. this holy but very personal God. It's not like He is not a force. He is a person who knows you and whom you can know and communicate with. This is our personal holy God who is in this very room as well as in the ocean. And so the answers to all these questions, of course, are you can't go anywhere where the God is not. If you were to go here, if you were to go there, if you go to there, He's always there. Verse 8, you are there, you are there. Verse 9, even there your hand will lead me and your right hand will lay hold on me. So it's not just that He's there, but His hand is still going to be on you. Even the darkness, the darkest, darkest spot, He's still there. And it's just like light to Him. And so even the darkest place of the universe, God is there. Even the dimension that we may not even know about, called heaven, right? We've never personally been there. We know it from the Word, but He's there. Every place, space, and time, God is there. And to boggle your mind, it's all at once. And so humanity has, in history, fled from that. And we might want to hide as well from this holy God. So humanity fears and flees from Him when we might draw near and find Him. We could find in Christ an access to this holy God and a personal relationship with Him, but ever since the beginning we have chosen to run. From the beginning to the end. You're taking notes, write down these two passages. One would be Genesis 3, 7 to 8. The first time we ran from God, Adam and Eve, they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loin coverings. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of God. So even from the very beginning, humanity has tried to hide from God. And all the way to the end of time, you turn to the last book of the Bible and you find the same thing. Humanity is still trying to hide from God. Revelation 6, verses 15 to 17. Then the kings of the earth, the great men and the commanders, the very wealthy and strong, hid themselves in the caves and the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains, "Fall on us, hide us from the presence of Him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb," of Jesus. Jesus is the Lamb. "For the great day of the wrath has come, and who is able to stand?" And so humanity has always tried to run from this holy God. But we have always learned we cannot, right? From beginning to end and all in between, Jonah we find trying to flee to the ocean, and he is found out. He takes a cruise that no one would want to take, right? To the belly of the whale, the great fish. But let me encourage you, you do not need to run from this God because He loves you. He loves you so much that He sent His Son, Jesus, to die in your stead and offer you free pardon. And actually room at His table. So that those who are saying, "Hide us from the Lamb," others are feeding at the table of the Lamb. And you can have fellowship with this great God through Jesus Christ. He loves you and has come to earth to live with you. He became a baby that we may have heaven. And so let me encourage you to draw near to God, and He will draw near too. Hide from His care. And you will not find Him who is always here, right? But in finding Him in Jesus, you have always access to this glorious, loving God. So we find God is omniscient, He's all-knowing, He's omnipresent, He is always here. And then lastly here, verses 13 to 16, look at God's wonderful artistry. Meditate on God's wonderful artistry, His wonderful knowledge, His wonderful presence, and His wonderful artistry. This is beautiful. Isn't this beautiful? Right, if you came in with a little bit of a complex about your self-worth, right, this should just take care of all of that. Understanding the truth of this passage. Verses 13 through 16. Meditate on God's wonderful artistry. "For you formed my inward parts. You wove me together in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are all your works. My soul knows this very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth, right? This area that we cannot enter in our own strength. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me when there was not yet even one of them. Look at all the active words in verses 13 to 16. Amazing words. Beautiful words. Your body, soul, and spirit were placed together in the womb. Your life is not an accident. There is a personal, loving God who has orchestrated your life. He has placed His image in each human being. Right? His made in His likeness. There's a likeness to God that Genesis talks about that says being made in His image that no other living thing has been given. Right? Or the dogs and cats, and they don't have this. Humanity is special in this way. In God's creation, He has created humanity to bear His mark, His picture, being communicators, body, soul, and spirit, reflecting the Trinity in that way. He forms your inward parts, verse 13 says. Literally, He fashioned together your organs, or literally in Hebrew, your kidneys. Right, God put together your kidneys in your mother's womb. But it's the idea for all the insides of you, all the inner workings of your clock. Right, all that stuff inside you, not just the organs, but all the things that make you tick. Right, your personality, your emotions, all those things inside you. God put all those workings together. They were put together by a holy God. God put your clock together. He made you just the way you are. Now we often mar that clock and misuse that clock, right? So our present standing may be kind of worse off than when He first gave us the watch, but He made you the way you are. The next image gets even more precious, right? Look at the next phrase. All right, you formed my inward parts, and look at that. You wove me together. You wove me together in my mother's womb. Isn't that an amazing picture? Thinking of God weaving something, making a beautiful tapestry. That's what's happening in the womb. God is weaving together individuals in the womb. Just a glorious thought, such a comforting thought. Right? This is a huge step forward in our understanding of ourselves, our image of ourselves. It can often be so poorly viewed because of pop culture today, where a lot of folks think that the only appearance that matters is the appearance that's on television or on these ads, or right, that's the appearance I have to appear as, or I'm not important. How silly! No, God made you the way you appear in your mother's womb. What an odd way to think of our appearance approval based on society. Your positive view of yourself is based on the fact that God created me this way. Right? With all of my idiosyncrasies, and maybe even some of my weaknesses, and yet He gives me a spirit to overcome those weaknesses, but He made me. Your height, right? You can't complain about these things. Your hairstyle, right? Well, I wish I had more hair. Well, God knew better. It's okay. Right? We can rest in the fact that I'm fearfully. Look at what it says. There's this awesomeness to the way you are made. The word wonderful He uses in the text. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. That word is used often to talk about God's miraculous works. Like things like bringing the children of Israel out of Egypt and stopping and parting the Red Sea. That is the work of a human. That is the work of you in the womb. It's a wonderful thing that God has done. Look at His wonderful works. And it's true. Biology is amazing. Mind-boggling, the miracle of a human being growing inside of another human being. Right, those of you ladies who are blessed and honored to be mothers, right, have this unusual experience that big chunk of humanity is not able to really appreciate, but we at least see it and we're amazed. It's a wonderful miracle. We haven't even begun to experience or talk about the new birth that all of us can take part in and experience. Just over a month of conception, after conception, that baby's heart starts beating. And unreal. 8 weeks, all the organs are there. All of them. God's formed all of them. He's done it all in just a couple months. By 10 weeks, the baby is sensitive to touch. 20 to 26 weeks, the child has a billion nerve cells. They listen to music. They react to things they don't like. In fact, even at that 5 month stage, they see people sucking their thumbs. They're eating. They're tasting, actually. Not just through the umbilical cord, but they're actually tasting up to a liter a day, I think I saw. At that stage, even at 5 months, babies have been born and survived. The babies, 28 weeks, their eyes open. They're able to see. They actually see twins looking at each other. Actually, touching their faces, holding hands, these twins in the womb. Unbelievable thought. They're hearing their mom and dad's voices, right? They're hearing these sermons, right? So, those of you who are expecting, it's a good thing to have them listen to. But I still remember Seth staring at me when he came out. And I'm sure the others did this, but he's like, that's where that voice comes from. That sound comes from that. Oh, brother, what am I in for? But I could tell he recognized that voice. It was a touching thing. This is a beautiful creation of God. I don't want to dwell on this, but I do think this is something that our culture is facing right now. It should not be a political debate. Right? This is not politics to say that this is a beautiful creation of God and should be protected, even by law. And the thing that our state has recently done is it's a tragedy. It really is. In allowing these children to be their lives to be taken up until birth, is the current legislation. And the fact that our governor actually celebrated that, right? Made it a celebration for our state. And I do think that we will see, in our lifetime, justice for that. And you can mark my words there. We know we will see it after our life. We'll see justice. And those who push this, right, our governor included, will face up to that. But what God has woven together, let not man tear asunder. I mean, just think of Jesus. These are not my words. Jesus' words. He said, it would be better for a millstone to be tied to your neck and be thrown into the sea. Those are strong words coming from Jesus. And we're thankful that the Lord is able to forgive even these things, right? And so we find hope in the gospel for past sins, but that's no reason to ignore it as a culture and as a church. God made you. It's not just that, but it's encouraging for me that God made me. And look, it goes beyond just this to all the days of my life He has made. He's made my future path. Right? Not just my eyes and my ears and my body and my insides, but all my days of my life were written in His book. It's kind of like He's already has my book on His shelf. And I don't need to fear about what's going on in my life. Right? What Pastor Andrew was talking about with Joseph last week. Even the horrible things and events that come into my life that I can't control, I can rest in God's sovereign care and His love for me, even in the difficult times, because I know that God is ultimately in control. God knows all your days, your dark days, your light days. President Truman put his neck out when he pushed several delegates to the UN to vote to recognize the Jewish state of Israel in 1947, a very difficult decision. But he had the State Department pushing him to not do that because they were looking at a war with Russia and they needed the Middle East oil. I'm going somewhere with this. But in spite of all that pressure, He chose to recognize Israel as a nation. And the response was celebration all over the world, especially in New York City, a huge celebration, 1947. Well, at that same time, the chief rabbi of Israel called the White House and quoted this verse. And he said, "God put you in your mother's womb so you would be the instrument to bring the rebirth of Israel after 2,000 years. Someone was in the room and heard that and responded, recorded this, "I thought the rabbi was overdoing things. But when I looked over at the president, tears were running down his cheeks." Right, to think that God has placed me in this life for these circumstances, for a specific purpose. Right, it's the same for you. It may not be to inaugurate a nation, but every day of our life is a gift from God. And it's just that way. It brings tears to our eyes to think of God's care. It brings a warm calm to our soul. No matter what I'm facing, God has made me for such a time as this, as Esther said. And it may be the sword, it may be a celebration, but this time, my time is in His hand. And Joseph was able to honor and please God in the prison as well as the palace. The psalmist encourages us that way as we meditate on God's creative power, not just of my substance, but of all my days, of all my days. And so we respond. We're out of time here. Let's just quickly respond. And we need to have the same responses here in verses 17 to 24 as we meditate on God's knowledge, as we meditate on God's presence, as we meditate on His creative power. We respond in wonder. We wonder at God. Look at His responses in verses 17 and following. The first response is to count His wonders. "How precious also are Your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I'm awake, I'm still with You." And so he's like numbering all the knowledge and glory of God. And I mentioned in my video this week, it's almost as if, and I saw this, a commentator actually said this, it's almost like he falls asleep there, counting the sand of the sea. He counts all the thoughts that God has for him, and he kind of loses track. Another thought of God, another thought of God. And we lose track. God knows when I sleep. This would be a good practice for you. Another thought, God knew my eye color before anything was ever made. Eternally, He knew my eye color. Before one page in my life was written, He knew the book. Another thought, God loves me. Another thought, God knows how I feel about a situation. He knows when I'm scared. He knows when I'm angry. He knows when I'm misunderstood or I'm misunderstanding. God knows everything I will face this week. These are the things He's counting. God knows the evil that's done to me. And as you continue to count that, you can fall asleep. It'd be a lot better than counting sheep. Right? Count all of God's knowledge every time you go to sleep. A beautiful way to fall asleep. And he's doing that. And then verses 19 and following, he loves God's name. I don't know if you read this. This sounds a little harsh. We go from this glorious psalm and then listen to what he does. He starts lashing out on those who do not follow God. Verses 19 to 22. "Oh, that You would slay the wicked. O God, depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed." Right? All of you who are doing violence, leave me. Depart from me. And then those who speak against God, verse 20. "They speak against You wickedly, and Your enemies take Your name in vain." And listen to what he says. Verse 21, "Do I not hate those who hate You?" Right, those who are despising God's name, not walking in His way, he actually says he hates them. "I hate them," verse 22, as if you didn't get it. Right? He says, "I loathe them," in verse 21, and maybe you say, okay, Tim, does he really say that? Well, look at verse 22. "I hate them with the utmost hatred. They've become my enemies." You can't get around that. I'd like to say it positively. He loves God's name. We shouldn't be surprised about the emotional response to something that you love. Right? I'm sure as we in just a minute we'll have these families come up. If I were to try to harm one of these babies, these husbands would be giving me black eyes. Right? I would be dead. Right? Why? They hate me just because they love that baby. Right? And this is the emotional attack. What's going on emotionally in this psalm? Right? This is a record of a psalmist's emotions, and he's thinking about the glory of God, and then he's thinking about those who hate God and who despise His way. And his culture did that. Right? They did the same things our culture did. And he too hates it. He hates it so much that he just loves God's way so much that it ends up spilling over in emotional response against those who hate God's way. And this is not just the Old Testament. This is all over the Bible. This is what Jesus did when he lashed out at the hypocrites who were self-righteous. When he called Herod, the political leader of his day, a fox. When he saw the abuse in the temple, what did Jesus do? Well, let's just sweep it under the rug. Well, I guess he wanted to sweep it under the rug when he overturned all the tables. But he made a whip and he drove them out of the temple saying, "This should be a house of prayer. Take these things away. Stop making my Father's house a place of business." You continue to read the New Testament. Paul had a similar response. 1 Timothy 1:19-20. Those who go against the faith, he says, among these are Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I have handed over to Satan, that they may be taught not to blaspheme. Paul talks even in harsher words, and I won't say what it is, but to those who teach a different gospel, who taught that you needed to do extra works to be right before God, he said, I wish that they were cut off. There's an emotional response to love, and that is to resist and even hate that which is against that which you love. Right, and so this is the same thing. It's the same emotional response. As we love God, we hate those who are against God's ways. And of course, we love them to life, and we want them to respond to the gospel and be eternally saved. Of course, that's the gospel. But in that emotional response of those who are hating God, it's just natural. They hate the God I love that I've given my life for. And so that's another response. And then our third response is to follow His way. Search me, O God. Okay, we think of this God, this amazing God, and we have to respond the same way in verses 23 and 24. Search me, O God. Know my heart. Try me. Right? Take a test of me and know my anxious thoughts and see if there's any heartful way of me. Lead me in the everlasting way. Lord, you know all about me. Please, lead me in the right way. You know all my paths. And if there is a way that I'm not following you, direct me in the right way. And this should be all of our heart's response to this psalm and to God's knowledge. Let's pray. With heads are bowed, eyes closed, let's all respond to God's word. Let's do that in a quiet prayer. And let's pray this. Would you pray this? This psalmist's prayer in your heart. Search me, O God. Know my heart. Lord, if there is anything in my heart that's resistant to you, please change that. Try me. Know my anxious thoughts. See if there be any hurtful way in me and lead me in the everlasting way. In a moment, we're going to close in prayer, but let's all have a time of quiet meditation in prayer. And then I'll close this in prayer in just a minute.